Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
Hey, I'm Serge. I use he, him pronouns.
I'm Chris. I use gender-neutral pronouns such as they, them.
So this is Libre Lounge, the COVID-19 exhausted hosts edition.
Not false.
How are you doing, Chris?
Well, exhausted, as you said. I feel like I have not been as productive as I usually have been over the last month, though I've been picking back up again. But even still, yesterday did some gardening and that's set up. But today, today was a little bit hard. What's going on with you?
Well, so I got up and went to, I have my laptop and I have my gaming computer, which I use, it's my desktop. So I also use it, for example, when I'm editing the show. So I went to my desktop and pressed a key and it was crunchy with crumbs. And so I decided at 7 a.m, I'm going to clean my keyboard.
You didn't opt for the creamy edition of keyboards. You went for crunchy.
Yeah, crunchy. I'm not going any further with that. So I take out all the keys and I have my special key remover and the whole thing. I clean each key off individually and with Windex and I have a whole thing. And then as I put one of the keys back, the stabilizer broke and I don't have a spare. And I realized that I really can't use this keyboard anymore. And so I decided to take a break and go on the Fediverse. And my Mastodon instance was broken. And it took me over an hour to fix the Mastodon instance. And I had to order a new keyboard. And the only other keyboard I had was in the closet. And it's an old PS2 keyboard. And it's terrible. So that killed most of the productivity for today.
And then you hopped on Mumble and we immediately started chatting, right?
Yeah. We use Mumble to record the show and we started talking and then my headset broke. Yeah. I'd actually forgotten that. Thanks for reminding me. So in fact, I probably sound worse than usual because I'm on a wireless headset while a new headset and keyboard are coming in the mail because, of course, with COVID-19 and me being in New York City, I can't really just go out and get replacement things. I have to order them online, and they're not essential. You know, they're not essential goods. Nobody will die if they don't have a new keyboard. So I don't expect it. I don't expect to get a new keyboard anytime soon, and I really need a new headset now, in addition to this one, because this one is not good for recording. So yeah, that's pretty much been my day, other than some of the work we've been doing, which I guess we might talk about either this time or some other time. But I think we were talking about this article, and we should share it with our friends here. I don't like saying the audience, man. That sounds so lame. Because I feel like we're on stage, and that's not how this feels to me. Like, this feels very, audio, especially radio, feels very intimate. So I don't think of, somebody who's listening, it's like the one person who's listening. I don't think about a collection. Anyway, we were talking about this article that I sent you because it was on Slashdot, and it was about the idea of the metaverse. And are we living in the metaverse? And I thought you might want to riff on that.
Well, yeah. So, I'm gonna say very briefly that this tied in with something. One of the reasons why I was kind of emotionally destroyed is, I don't regret it. There's some small chance that the person might end up hearing this. I guess probably not, but I got an email from a friend, the ex of a friend, who I guess content warning I'm about to talk about some about death. So if you're listening with kids, maybe bear that in mind. I have a friend who committed suicide about close to a decade ago, and he was really, really close to me. I'm not going to say who exactly it was in relationship to them, but, there was a person who contacted me who was very close to them and had some thoughts and commentary on a blog post I wrote shortly after they died. And the reason why this ties in is I then ended up going and that person had known, my friend Matt, partly through this game called Grail that we both played, which I might have mentioned on the show before, which is like this kind of an online massively multiplayer RPG before massively multiplayer RPGs were really like a big thing. It kind of felt like the 2D Legend of Zelda that you played top down. Me and all my friends really got into that game when I was a kid. And it's actually how I started programming in some ways, is that it had, you could hit a button and there was this level editor and you could play it, but it was also, you know, a game that you played online with people. And, you know, this person had met him through that. And I searched online for his name after that email. And I found other messages from people who had played that game with him. And, you know, that really hit home a bunch of emotional things because, it was these people who knew my friend through that world and had these experiences running around and talking to him, this person I had known in real life and in the game. And in many ways, you know, for a long time, I've always been a fan of things like, you know, Serial Experiments Lane and kind of cyberpunky things and stuff like that, where there's this question of identity of, you know, to riff on a Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared. It, you know, it's not you, it's your digital you, virtually real, but controlled by real you. Like, what's the difference between your online identity and your virtual identity? And it's weird because right now, amidst this pandemic, stuff where, you know, people who maybe previously felt like they had a hard line between their virtual representation of self and their digital representation of self, I don't feel like there's, you know, lines are blurring, right? You know, in many ways, many people may feel that the virtual presentation that they have of themselves is as real or more real than the one that's walking around. I don't know. That was a lot of rambling, but it's where my headspace is.
I guess one thing that I think is often lost in these discussions is that, well, so spoilers a little bit for people that haven't seen Westworld, the HBO series. It's a lot of these discussions, a lot of these themes are discussed in season 2 of the series. But I think the difference between the way I imagined the virtual world and the connection between one's virtual identity and real identity in the 90s and today is that I think that the way we're connecting our digital, quote-unquote, digital identities is actually far more either aspirational or at least emphasizing a particular part of who we are rather than a separate us. So one could make an argument that, for example, if you're a parent, you know, a parent of a child, that you're never your full self with them, right? They don't need to know about certain adult, you know, aspects of your life, just the same way that, you know, if you have a teacher or professor, you know, you only see a certain part of them, and maybe even a coworker, right? You only see a certain part of that person. But I would say that's even more amplified in when one has these kind of open world gaming experiences. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, lines shift and blur and then they don't, right? You know, I think that setting down hard boundaries isn't easy, and I think that it can actually be good that people have segmented versions of themselves, right? You know, the as you've said, people have always had that, right? You know, if you've got somebody who is a as you said, a teacher, and then they, you know, go and then play video games with their friends later or board games, they're going to act very differently, or and maybe even think and present, you know, themselves very differently. You know, let's just talk about board games, no computers whatsoever, right? You know, that distinction might be totally fine. They also might be a writer of things online. And I think that people do segment themselves in ways, and that can be fine. And then occasionally you find things bleed over from space to space. I'm not sure, you know, I guess I'm much more of a fuzzy typist and fuzzy thinker than maybe many other people, where I think that a lot of things end up being really blurry around the edges. And I think that identities, especially, I think that's okay. I think one of the nice things about digital environments is that sometimes, historically at least, it's been possible to create an identity that is independent of your other identities and use that as a space to explore yourself in a way that might not have been possible or safe previously. And I guess there's this idea, there's this term called context collapse, where instead of having these separate segmented identities, which again, we've always had, suddenly you end up having a unit identity. And then this can be a challenge, even if, you know, if somebody who, you know, they might go out and drink, you know, you had this situation where, you know, when Facebook appeared, and Facebook's kind of whole perspective is, yeah, collapse everything, you know, have a context collapse of everything. And then suddenly people start getting tagged in photos of them drinking at a bar, and that might affect things with their employer, right? You know? So I guess I feel like I would like to see a lot more freedom for people to be able to experiment with segmenting and then merging back in aspects of their identity. And I maybe feel like maybe the infrastructure we've kind of developed doesn't always accommodate that. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
It does make sense. When I think about exploration, you know, the obvious one that comes to my mind is that I know trans people who the first place that they could explore their gender identity was video games,
mm-hmm.
right? Where they could take on the attributes, the physical attributes of the gender that they more closely identified with.
Mm-hmm.
And then the physical body that they were inhabiting.
Yeah.
You know, and I also think we see that in other ways. You know, I will say, I think especially as it relates, for example, to sexuality, we see that online too. People are, you know, when broken of the constraints of their quote unquote real lives, they can explore aspects of themselves that they may not have. You know, kind of, I mean, you mentioned a number of good resources to view or read, and I would say Westworld season one explores those themes of, you know, what happens when we can break out of the constraints of real life. But I also agree with you that Facebook in particular worked really hard to collapse that simply for the purposes of marketing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that they wanted to be able to, marketing and influence, is that they wanted to be able to generate a complete profile on who you are, including all those different things. And so to them, you know, they didn't want people making six Facebook profiles, each representing a piece of their identity. They wanted one unified, marketable identity.
Yeah. So going back to the gender stuff, and you know, I also have a lot of friends who identify as transgender, and you know, who are transgender, who where games were their first opportunity to be able to explore their identity. And you know, I've mentioned that I'm non-binary. I use gender neutral pronouns, and even the introduction to this episode, I kind of give an awkward mouthful with, you know, I use non-binary pronouns such as they, them. Part of the reason for that is that there was an old game called Lamdimu. It was one of the earliest massively multiplayer MUDs, really, massively multiplayer games, and it had you could choose your pronoun options, and one of them was Spivak, which was kind of very rarely known, put out there by a mathematician, and it used E, M, Air, blah blah blah, and it was just one of the options, and I think maybe even the default option, I forget, and you know, that really struck me, like, oh, you know what, if we were going to construct a language, and, you know, language is a social construct, and what are the choices that we make? And one of them might be, you know, do we include gendered pronouns? The seeing Spivak on there felt very freeing for me, even though you could choose all these other pronoun options too. And for me, that changed a lot of my thinking. And, you know, the reason I have that mouthful of, you know, gender neutral pronouns such as they, them, is because I also know that it's really hard to work outside of the framework of what people are exposed to. And you can only push for so much at once. And I'm excited that they, them is an option, even though it's not really my preferred state. So I don't know, you know, that being able to have spaces like that to explore things and think about things is I think can be really important and useful.
I'm wondering if we want to go down the gender pronoun rabbit hole.
Sure, sure.
Because, you know, I've thought about this question. I mean, so when we go to meetings in person nowadays, it's pretty common, at least in the circles that I inhabit, which is, you know, a lot of progressive groups. For example, we had Rory from Cyper, and they are a group that announces their pronouns. The speakers do, at least. And usually you just announce your pronouns, right? So if I say, well, I'm he, him, that doesn't speak to my gender identity. That just speaks to my preferred pronouns. And of course, preferred pronouns can also change, right? So I might say, well, I'm he, him today, and maybe tomorrow I don't. Maybe I don't identify in that same way, but I don't say, well, I use masculine pronouns. Because I think one of the ideas of the modern thinking is that pronouns aren't inherently gendered. They're just the pronouns that we identify with, and they have traditional associations with gender, obviously, but pronouns are not inherently gendered.
Well, I mean, what is inherent about gender at all, right? Gender is a social construct, and we still are having a choice to have these pronouns that are thus being selected at all, right, as applied to people. And I don't think that the net effect of having gendered pronouns, if you know, is all that useful. Personally, I don't think that. And like, you know, okay, yes, maybe the pronouns could represent all sorts of identity things that are not just gender. But what's gender is the primary thing that's being conveyed. I think the most common, you know, plurality or singularness is also one thing that's commonly conveyed, and that's a whole other topic itself. But I think that there's a lot of studies that show just how much is there when you just how much somebody ends up pre-setting thoughts and associations just by hearing a gendered pronoun. And so I don't know. I think that. You know, again, by saying, you know, I use gender neutral pronouns such as, that's because I'm trying to work within the context of what we have here in our society. And I'm trying to give a hint that, you know, maybe this isn't exactly the framing I'd like, but it's the framing we have. And you know, and I'm just trying to work with that. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts, because you said a lot of different things. So, and I think I'm going to lose at least one of them. So one of the thoughts that I had was that you're right, that that perceptions of gender identity absolutely affect ideas of quality. And in fact, I ran a study in my undergraduate days. I have a degree in psychology about which it had been already massively studied that knowing that having an author's name be having the first name of an author associated with a gender, so you know, Jane versus John, would affect a reader's perception of the quality of the work,
mm-hmm.
with a negative association if the author was a female. At the time, that was well studied, and so we did a variation where we had people watch a women's sports team playing a game for a few minutes, and then basically saw if there was an effect on their perceptions. And we had a control group where we didn't give them the video, or we either had it or another video. Anyway, we did a bunch of variants, and we absolutely showed that that this bias is real, and we could adjust it somewhat by showing women's sports teams, which was a weird result. But and then there was something else you said, and I can't remember what it is, but it was important.
I'm not sure, because as you said, I said a bunch of things, but
yeah, it was hard to keep track.
but I have something I can follow up on with that kind of builds on that. I also want to acknowledge that gender is something, at least something that I can address as a topic, and there's a lot more. You know, there are all sorts of perceptions that people end up getting, right? Of course, you know, like people have enormous perceptions based off of whether or not a name sounds, you know, sounds like it's of an African descent, you know, and skin tone and all sorts of things like that. And I'm also aware of what limited effects that people have to be able to affect some of those things, or even desire, right? And I'm also limited in how much of experiences I can speak to, but I think that so I'm gonna say the first memory I have, and the first and I don't think it was meant as a form of ridicule, but the first memory I have is being asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, a girl. And my mom and my sister thought this was very funny, and they dressed me up in her dress. And there's a picture of that. And that's the first memory I have any association with it. I don't even remember I don't know if I actually remember that myself, or if it's that the story was told so much that I have this memory kind of implanted there. But it's like, you know, kind of, and that's, and I think it was always portrayed in this kind of friendly fashion. But in another sense, it's also kind of, but I still kind of felt ashamed when I heard that story. And as if it was, you know, kind of ridiculous, you know? And I think that right now I'm playing a game, you know, I've mentioned this before, it's a proprietary game, but I'm playing a game called Animal Crossing. And one of the interesting decisions that they made in there is when you start up your character, they say, and this is a departure from previous games, they say, choose your style. And they just show two characters with, you know, kind of a masculine and feminine hairstyle. And that's all the gender selection there is in the game. Other than that, you're able to wear any clothes, you're able to do whatever, and everything's open to you. And that feels very liberating when playing the game, that there aren't those constraints, which there were previously. And previously, they made a decision, which was, you know, the contemporary decisions, that once you made that initial selection, that it was a very hard set thing, you couldn't change it, and that it limited what choices you had available. And I think even that, you know, when I think about the systems I want to create, that's the kind of thing I want to aspire to, is to have, is to really give people the freedom to be able to choose things about their expression and explore things about their expression and not feel ashamed for it, and not feel like there's artificial constraints put on it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it kind of makes me feel like the thing I had in mind was really trivial compared to what you're saying, because it was. So thank you for sharing that. I mean, I've known you for several years, and I've never heard that story before, and that's really intense. And I don't mean intense in any particular way other than just, gee, that seems like a very intense thing, and it seems like it had a big impact on you emotionally.
Well, yeah. I don't know.
Go so, Nick, do you wanna say more?
I don't have anything more on that topic. I just have more thoughts on digital identity. So continue.
Well, okay. So let's before we jump into digital identity, we should do that because this is a software, you know, user freedom show. You know, there are languages that don't have gendered pronouns, and you know, one that I studied for a while was American Sign Language. And in American Sign Language, pronouns are just physical spots. So, you know, if you want to, you point to an area and that becomes that person, you know, there's no gender associated with a point, right? It's literally where they are in the, you know, where they are in the physical space that you're representing them. Mm-hmm. And, I also wanted to talk a little bit about your Spivak pronouns, because when you brought that up, I find it challenging to pronounce them. And I did a little research on pronouns. And it turns out that, so English is weird, right? So we have he, him, you know, he, him, his, mm-hmm. and she, her, hers. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that Middle English, the third person singular was hit. So it was, you know, his, hers, and hits. And I was thinking, like, well, that's much easier to pronounce than the Spivak version, which I believe is E.
E, right? Yeah, it's E. Yeah, it's E. Air, M, well, it's EM air. And you're right. It's, so I'm not saying Spivak. So I want to make it something clear. I actually don't think Spivak is necessarily also a panacea. I just think that it was a really interesting and wonderful thing to see somebody, you know, produce this thing that's, you know, a singular gender neutral pronoun that you could just apply everywhere by default. And I mean, I actually have a really bad memory.
But I want to kind of, oh, sorry. You're going to talk about your memory now. Now I feel bad again.
No worries. I was just going to say, actually, I mean, I have a really bad memory in some ways. Actually, the other way I learned to program is that I failed the states and capitals test, I think, 3 or 4 times that I wrote a program in QBasic to teach me states and capitals so I would finally pass.
You built a, I mean, I've done that too, but it's like building a robot to teach you.
I'm aware. But the other aspect of that is, where was I going?
Sorry.
Right. About memorization. Yeah. Memory. My memory is very bad. And I'm really bad, especially at things that are associative. I have name face blindness. So it's when people say, you know, what's your pronoun? That's an additional thing I have to put into that box along with face and name. And I'm always afraid I'm going to fail at it. And because I already fail at face and name. And so I don't know. That doesn't mean I don't try. Absolutely. I'm trying, you know, for people, but that it's to me, it's also kind of nice that, you know, to downplay the importance, and Spivak's just one example of a system we could use to downplay it. There are other alternate gender-neutral pronouns that maybe aren't so vowel-y, and those are fine too.
Well, I was going to say, I wanted to kind of continue on and say that the other words we have are like, for example, this and hit are connected.
Mm.
I also have name and face blindness and ADHD and memory problems. So you and I are really similar in a lot of those ways. And one of the things that makes English actually easy is that we don't have gendered objects that don't have a gender identifier, usually suffix. And in fact, gender identifier suffixes are kind of dying out, right? Like we don't really use the et very, very much, you know, which is borrowed from French. And usually those things are also, or like, for example, actress, you know, as opposed to actor. Nowadays, we would just say, you know, she is an actor rather than, you know, she's an actress, unless we're trying to do it for some specific reason. Anyway, by the way, there are other great podcasts on language that we can recommend, but let's jump back into how this applies to work we do.
Yeah.
Which is, the assumptions on gender in video games or in any software can absolutely have an impact. And I thought that the whole idea that you brought up about style, right? Choose your style is great. I mean, it's, because that doesn't, well, it doesn't imply anything. And I think that that's when we're building software generally, we should be thinking about either the flexibility of like, well, choose your own pronouns, right? If that's how it's going to be, or just, you know, getting rid of all the pronouns, you know, in the design, or getting rid of all the gender, you know, assumptions or other, you know, and there's a ton of cultural assumptions that we make that, you know, I think this gives us an opportunity to really question, you know, just like a lot of these systems, for example, you know, a lot of, governments, you know, they have, binary gender choices. And now we're seeing some governments having gender neutral options. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wonder about other things that maybe, you know, I'm not even thinking about. I'm not even aware of the way that I am imposing my assumptions on someone.
Yeah. I think there's always also a negotiation between people of what assumptions are and aren't correct, right? You know, we have, it would be nice to believe that we could be completely logical beings, but we know that's not how we work. First of all, we have to be able to develop concepts, and then we have to figure out, you know, how to map those concepts, and we're going to get a lot wrong. And a lot of those concepts will be artificially constructed. I guess that sounds very abstract, but you know, I think that, I don't know. I actually think that there's such a rich vein of a topic here that I'm afraid that if we tried to go into it, we'd never get out. This episode would never end because there's a lot I would love to talk about identity and names, as in terms of, you know, even equality of like, how do you see if two things are the same? But I think that actually, let's hold off on that. That definitely has to be its own episode because that there's no way we can fit that in a reasonable amount of time before this thing ends. But I think that here's what I want to say. It's hard to get these things right in systems. And I don't blame all systems for not always getting it right in the past if we're trying to figure out how to identify how to make them better for the future. Because you and I, if we try to be the most progressive people that we are, if society goes well and goes in a good direction, we should be accused correctly of having made serious mistakes because we couldn't see it from the vantage point that we're at right now. And that's not to excuse us, you know, if looking back at like, you know, if I'm making a mistake right now, I'm not saying, you know, like, you know, oh, you know, it's also not to excuse a past of like racism and sexism and bigotry and et cetera. But I think that I'm more interested in trying to learn about how to build a better tomorrow than I am in accusations about mistakes from the past that are they're easier to see in hindsight. We should do a lot of digging about that type of stuff, but I'm really interested in, if we're designing systems right now, what do we understand? What do we know? How can we better accommodate? And how can we listen to people to help better accommodate people from their experiences? And I don't know.
Yeah, I think these are hard questions, because what I was trying to get to was that, you know, we have a gender neutral singular pronoun in English. You know, we have it, but it in our vernacular is a dehumanizing pronoun, right? You only use it for inanimate objects. People used to use it for animals, and even that's kind of frowned upon. That's an Englishism, right? Because there are other languages in which those assumptions don't hold true. And that ties very much into what you then just said, which is, you know, how do we listen to people? How do we break some of those assumptions? And look, it doesn't matter all that much when we're talking about, you know, a music player, or even, or an email client necessarily. But it makes a big difference if we're talking about building social network software, things that have, or we're trying to classify people, right? We're building a system that classifies people based on this or that, especially in a way that they could be interacting with each other. I think that's where we do need to be sensitive. I don't have an answer of how we listen to people. I mean, we can, other than, you know, being open to hearing, because it can also be challenging when you have limited resources and so many different people that would like you to design things in a certain way. It can be very challenging. It's a good challenge, but it can be very difficult to achieve.
Well, it's especially good if you can put stuff in your software to put the tools in the hands of users so that they can help you do the right thing. And I think that actually ties into, I don't know how long we want to go on this episode, but I think that there's something there about, now that we've put down a lot about some of the challenges that we've experienced and what we'd like to do in the present. But what I'm really, especially where my mind is always at, is what can we do for the future? And when we're talking about building social systems moving towards the future, I'm sometimes accused of being a little bit too sci-fi-ish here, maybe rightly so. But I like to think about what can we do to put tools directly in users' hands, and what does that mean for building a social system? So I don't know. Do we want to talk aspirationally about where we think things could go in these types of things, or is that just too far out there?
Yeah, I mean, no, I don't think it's too far out there. I'm curious about specifically what you. I mean, I'm assuming, based on the fact that we've worked together and we've talked about things, some of this on the podcast, and we've talked about some of this in conferences and things, that you're going to talk about pet names. I'm just guessing, but maybe I could be wrong.
I think that,
and
yeah, mm-hmm. You should finish. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, pet names, but and I actually think that there's an inherent conflict in the pet name system with self identity, and that's a challenge that you and I have discussed privately, which is I'll let you go there. But also, what other types of identifiers can we use other than simple textual ones?
Yeah, so I think I would like to do an entire episode on names and pet names. I feel like it is long enough that it could be an hour. And that's not to say that pet names are that confusing. It's just that there's so much to explore with the idea of names that I'd really like to give it time. But you're right that's one component that I think is really important. And one of the things that I think is, you know, kind of digging around in computer science literature to see what helps us better address the problems of what we really want to solve today. I think pet names is one of those things. But I want to be a little bit more imaginative at this moment and think about, because I feel like maybe this amount of time we have left is better suited for some imagination, and think about, you know, one of the reasons that I've kind of framed Sprightly as being something that it has not achieved yet, except for in some kind of weird ways, of being, you know, like we're gonna bring a game to a distributed social network. And you can see the biases that I've had in my history, in my youth, and et cetera, in terms of that idea that there isn't such a big distinction between games and social networks. We're seeing that a lot right now and I keep going back to a proprietary game, but there's been a lot of articles recently about that in Animal Crossing. I should hand it over to you because you just sent me one earlier about that. Do you want to explain what that was?
I mean, yeah. So Animal Crossing is this weird. I've not played Animal Crossing. I have no issue with the game's goals, but man, I do not like the way the game looks. But people are using it as a forum for social protest. And I think my understanding is, and I could be wrong, that China has banned, I don't think they've banned the use, but I think they banned the sale of Animal Crossing, or it's something along those lines. I don't have the article in front of me. I apologize. But I know that you're a big fan of Animal Crossing, and I know a lot of other people are. It's like Nintendo's like number one selling game right now.
It's not the game that really matters to me at the moment. It's the idea.
But the way it's being used.
Yeah, it's the way that it's being used as a social network. Like, that's what's interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Is that it's a social network. Is that you're connecting to other people, going over to their space, exploring their space. And you have very limited tools that you can use to be able to build and explore and et cetera, but it does explore some. And you can see how much, because of people feeling trapped in the COVID-19 crisis, that people are really embracing the tools that have been handed them. And I think there's a lot more that we could do, right? Look, you can see the biases of this in my work going back, you know, a long way. The Liberated Pixel Cup project we did looks a lot like Grail or a top-down 2D Zelda for that reason, is that I think that you want to be able to have a collaboration space where it's easy enough to have a visually distinct set of things that people can combine and add to. Right now, don't have anything like that in the free software space that's kind of a coherent project that lets people kind of visit each other, that kind of gives people a space to collaborate that's not just textual and other kind of audiovisual things. That really feels like a space where you're walking together and where you can build things and say, like, come to my space and, like, see this kind of things that I've built, where, you know, you and your friends should be able to build kind of a life together to explore. I know I'm really rambling here, but I'm going to pull it back to Matt. My friend Matt made one of the things I only found out about after his death is that he made a card game in Grail, which is like a trading card game that you could play. Because the game gave you the ability to add to it, the ability to program the game. And I never even knew that he learned to program at all. And he added this to one of the servers. And I think that that's really cool and empowering, and the kind of things that I want to be able to see is where, you know, a few weeks ago, I had our family vacation was canceled, but I had, you know, my family members come over and, you know, visit my island and the game. And we were talking on the phone, and it felt like a reunion. I think that if we don't do it, somebody else is going to do it. And I actually see Animal Crossing as a not very good version of these things. Nintendo has a lot of restrictions of what things you can do and visit each other for good reasons, because they're trying to run, you know, an entertainment empire, and they've really locked down just how much you can collaborate together. But if we had something that we were intending to hand to users, I think there's a lot more that we can do. I don't know.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks everyone for the,
I'm sorry.
There's just so much. There's so much there. And there's, you know, I don't know how we even begin to take that apart. When I said goodbye, that wasn't a knock against you. It was more like, okay, well, the scholars will be studying this for the next decade. And
well, they'll certainly, you know, be studying this moment. Yeah. And the way that it's impacting the way that people change their relationships with each other.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I know for myself, there's another aspect to these games, I think, that is sometimes lost when people think about games, which is, I call it like the sitcom, but I specifically call it the Cheers effect. So Cheers was this American sitcom in the 1980s, and then I guess in the early 90s. And the tagline was, where everybody knows your name. It was about a bar, you know, a bar slash pub in Boston, where everybody knows your name. And at the time, you know, you'd watch it and it felt very much like you were part of this, you know, this community of these people, and, you know, everybody knew each other and everybody greeted one another. And there's definitely an element of that, you know, games, good games like, you know, Stardew Valley and I guess Animal Crossing and MUDs that I've played on can feel like that. It's familiar. Another game that I've played that isn't as social is Saints Row 4. And even Saints Row 4, even though it's a dystopian world, has an element of like, yeah, well, it's the same, and I know where everything is, and, you know. Well,
there are some free software games, I think we can give credit to that. I mean, there's a lot of cultural attachment to the in-jokes of NetHack, for instance, right? And that mm-hmm. world, as you explore it, starts to feel familiar. And similarly, even Wesnoth, I think they're, you know, I mean, by pulling into the classic fantasy tropes, there's some room for cultural criticism. But I think that there's a lot of nice things that they've done for building out a comfortable world there. And so, I don't know, is world building what you meant kind of there?
No, I don't mean world building. I mean familiarity.
What's your distinction there?
I think you can do world building that doesn't feel so in the popular, you know, in the popular genre, you know, Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien doesn't feel familiar.
It doesn't?
There are, you know, not when you actually read it. It doesn't, not for me. I mean, if you reread it, sure.
But what about Star Trek? Because, like, I mean,
that's a great topic.
I mean, like, if you see people show up at a Star Trek convention, they feel very, like, that world feels very real to them.
Yes. And that there's two things, I think, that make it feel that way. So one is that Star Trek, especially, you know, original series and Next Generation, was episodic, right? So you had this similar structure to a sitcom, and that you had this kind of reset. You always had this reset, and even, you know, and maybe small things would change, but the structure of the show never really went through any radical transformation. But the more important part is that Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, even said, well, he didn't structure the show around a real military structure. He structured it around the family structure. Everybody played a role, you know, like you would in a large family, not like you would in a military organization or even a workplace. It doesn't feel like a workplace.
You know, I'm going to counter what you just said there by saying that I went to, and I don't think it was the best one I've ever been to. But I did go to a few years ago at FOSDEM, a keynote by Larry Wall. And I was telling my friend, yeah, show up to this keynote by Larry Wall. It's so great. Yeah, he's such a funny speaker. You're going to enjoy it. And then we show up there and he just talked about Lord of the Rings the whole time and how we all felt connected to Frodo and Bilbo and blah, 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 and their journeys and how, and like, and I was like, what? This is like, and my friend was just staring at me like, what talk did you just bring me to? Right. So like, I mean, do you think that level of familiarity really may vary though, depending on what your immersion is in it?
That might be. I guess what I would say is, but you brought up world building the same as connection and familiarity? And I would say that world building alone isn't. There has to be an emotional resonance to it. And I would even say repetition. And you know, the thing about someone like, you know, a Stephen Colbert or apparently a Larry Wall is that they're very familiar with this material. That, I mean, if you only read it once, you don't feel, you know, you don't feel it's familiar. You might feel an emotional resonance.
Well, this is one reason I was really glad that we had on David Revoy, on our previous episode, is that one thing I really appreciate about Pepper and Carrot is it's a pretty rare example of what we've had so far of kind of an ongoing amount of world building and you know, even as you say, kind of building up of that familiarity, like enough exposure to it starts to feel like something coherent, right? And I would like to see more of that in the free cultural / free software space, especially the intersection of that. I'd say games are a good example of an intersection of both free software and free culture, but we haven't really seen that much of that kind of cultural continuation of a sense of space in free software, I feel like.
Yeah, and we haven't seen something that you do see in these proprietary games, oddly, which is a ton of collaboration. Mm-hmm. Some of them are by design. You know, Grail, as you pointed out, had just all people working on it and modding it. I mean, you did have that in Lambda Mu and other MUDs. You absolutely had tons of that. But, you know, there is a gigantic community of modders, you know, people that are modifying proprietary games. And every time I see that, I'm like, why aren't they with us? Like, why aren't they working on our stuff? You know, instead of making a proprietary game better, why aren't they making our world, you know, our game better? Our games better. And I think we in the free software community need to be drawing those people in so that they want to be spending time modding and updating our stuff.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that I can't think of too many examples of it. I can think of a few examples. I think that Wesnoth and Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup are really the only ones that are jumping to the top of my mind where I'm like, wow, like I'm really seeing like a forum of people sharing ideas and collaborating and building things.
FreeCiv, there is too, but it's, you're right, it's not as big.
It's not as big. We'd love to see more of it.
OpenTTD.
And in some ways it feels like it should be in our wheelhouse, right? Because like it is that way for developing software often, right? Like, you know, like, oh, right, this looks like a cool community. This looks like a cool project. I want to bring some stuff to it. And I feel like free software has done it more than free culture has.
I agree with you completely.
I mean, I guess
that free culture has not lived up to its potential as of now. Of collaboration as a component of free culture is definitely missing.
Yeah, and it's not missing everywhere, but it just hasn't developed as strongly as we have seen for free software. And I'd like to see more work to that contrary. But I think we're getting really close to the hour mark. So do you think it's time to wrap it up, or do you have anything else that?
Yeah, no. I mean, boy, we've talked about a lot on this episode. We talked about, you know, we've talked about gender. We've talked about pronouns.
What on earth is going to be the title of this episode?
I think you've just made the title.
This what is, on earth is the title of this episode?
Yeah, that's those TV shows and movies where you know you realize that the whole thing is about the creation of the very thing you're watching at the end. Like, what on earth is the title of this episode? Is I think going to have to be the title of this episode.
Perfect, perfect. It couldn't be better. So, it couldn't be better.
So yeah. Speaking of collaboration, before we sign off, just want to remind people that they can reach us, communicate with us on #LibreLounge on IRC on the Freenode network. They can email us podcast@LibreLounge.org. We don't get very much email. Email is exciting. If you have feedback, send that feedback along. And speaking of feedback, this is one I don't usually ask for, but it really actually makes a big difference. So we do not recommend you use proprietary podcast aggregators, but I know that a lot of you are using proprietary podcast aggregators. If you are anyway, please rate and review the series, rate and review Libre Lounge. It actually does improve improves the ranking, which means that we get more people who might stumble upon the show. And that means that they're more likely to keep listening and maybe become free software users or contributors, or free culture users or contributors. And that's really important.
If there are any free ones, do that there too. But I'm not really sure if any are active anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Places to rate and review podcasts. But anywhere you can rate and review podcasts, if you like the show, then please rate and review us. If you don't like the show, then please don't rate and review us.
Classic podcast ending right there.
So, and you can also find us in the Fediverse. We're at Libre Lounge at floss.social. And, we're also on Twitter at Libre Lounge. So, and of course our website, LibreLounge.org. Was there anything else before we go, Chris?
Nope. I'm going to go get some rest.
Okay. All right. I think I will do the same. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. All right. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at LibreLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joth, which is waived into the public domain under CC0 and which you can find on opengameart.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.